Okay. Now we can move on to two use cases of autonomy dilemmas. And what I'm going to want to try to do here is talk about actual examples of how autonomy questions, ethical questions, have arisen in the real world in artificial intelligence. These are both cases that I have worked on myself with other computer scientists and, in this case, doctors and lawyers, to try to think about how autonomy happens in the real world, in real AI devices. And so I've got two of those examples. One has to do with, the second has to do with insurance. The first has to do with healthcare. So we'll do that, and then we'll look at challenges to autonomy. But the first case is a healthcare case. This is a company I worked with, I guess it's been more than a few years. It's been a number of years ago now. But it's a good case. Cardicio. What this company did or does is they, you don't need to see a doctor or anything like that. It's just a private company. You just walk off the street, go into the office, and they will take an EKG of your heart, you know, the thing of your heart going. Now, if you just watch on TV, you see the little line of the heartbeat. It looks like it's just kind of two little waves, a big bump and a little bump. But actually, it's not that. If you measure an EKG carefully, there are all kinds of little measurements that you can take in a heartbeat. Because as it happens, there's actually four, I think I'm remembering correctly, it's been a number of years now, I think I'm remembering correctly, don't quote me on this, I think there are four pockets in your heart that are kind of move the blood through your system, and each of the pockets kind of beat in a kind of rhythm, an undulating rhythm here in your chest, and that creates a wave which is actually very complicated. It's not just up and down, like big, small, that kind of thing. There's all kinds of little measurements you can take. And that's what I show here on this slide. There are for every single heartbeat, you can measure all of these various distances in terms of time and in terms of strength. And that's just one heartbeat. You can imagine that going on over time. So what Cardicio does is they get those measurements, and this is a perfect case for artificial intelligence. Why? Because studying these heartbeats, just one EKG produces massive amounts of data. All these measurements you see, and that's way, way too many for a human mind to conceptualize or grasp. A human mind just cannot make sense of all of these many measures, and certainly can't compare all of these many measures over a whole line, let's say 5 minutes of my heartbeat, with those of other patients. It's just too much information, way too much, astronomically too much. But AI handles that easily, right? AI easily compares millions of data points, right, from my EKG, my 5 minute EKG, with that same number of data points with 100,000 other EKG strips that it has acquired or purchased on the market, right? And then once it does that, then the AI can find very quickly, can find connections and say, look, Brousseau, your heartbeat is like these three other heartbeats. And I'm just making this up again. Bad news. These three other people all died of a heart attack within 2 months of having that kind of EKG. Or let's be more optimistic. Your heartbeat corresponds very well with these other five people, and good news, these other five people lived to be in their above hundreds before they had any heart problems. So great, good for you, right? Bad news, good news, who knows? But the point is that the Cardicio could produce this information much, much better. I mean, infinitely better than a human doctor. Human doctors can't even begin to compare with the kind of analytical power that artificial intelligence has in this little area, that is, of studying the EKG. Of course, human doctors can synthesize information much better between kind of your heart plus how you report you feel plus other kinds of things. So no one is saying that AI is replacing human doctors, but in this small area, yes, Definitely. AI does it much better than any human. Much, much better. And Cardicio was in that business. And because this is non-invasive, they didn't need any medical license or anything, right? You just go in voluntarily. Very cheap and easy. They just put the things in your chest and sit there for 5 minutes. You're done. Go home. That's it. And they run the software. They compare you. And this is what Cardicio did. They said, look, we compare your heartbeat with that of hundreds of thousands of others and all the little measures and things. And they produced, initially, they produced two measures, green and red. Green was great, all good, don't worry. Red is, uh-oh, you've got a problem. Now, that sounds like, in the abstract, that sounds like it makes sense, right? That's kind of what you want. You either want the green or the red. The problem is, where do you put that threshold? Where do you put the red threshold? If the Cardicio thing, the Cardicio EKG analysis shows that you have a 99% probability of dying within the next 2 hours, yes, that should probably be red, right? I mean, you want that information right now to go straight to the hospital. But if the Cardicio thing shows that you have a 9% chance of dying within the next 9 years, and let's say you're my age, well, that's kind of, it's a remote, it's 1% a year, right? That probably kind of fits about with what you would think. I mean, it's really unlikely that someone of my age is just going to have a heart attack, but the truth is it could happen, right? People, at any age, really, when you get out of bed, young people die of all kinds of crazy things. Not frequently, but it does happen. So if you come up with, Cardicio says, look, your heart is not perfect, right? It doesn't correspond with those people who live to 100 and never had any heart stuff. It corresponds instead with these people who have this very slight risk. Well, should that be red or should that be green? This is the difficulty. Where do you draw the line? We're asking this within the context of autonomy. Why? Because this is a big autonomy inhibitor. I mean, if I go to Cardicio and Cardicio says, look, so your heart isn't bad, you could die at any moment. I'm going to make all kinds of changes. First, I'm going to stop eating cookies. I love cookies. I'm going to stop drinking beer and wine and all that kind of stuff. My life is going to be a lot less fun. Right? It's not just less fun, but I'm going to diminish my own autonomy, my own, or am I? We'll have to talk about this now. And it seems like maybe I'm going to diminish my own autonomy because I'm not going to let myself make determinations any longer about having beer. Should I have another beer or not? Should I have another cookie or not? Because I'm worried that I'm deathly feared that I'm afraid that I'm going to die at any moment. So if you have this red prognosis from Cardicio, right? I mean, you probably will limit your life. You will probably, maybe I won't travel because I don't want to be away from the hospital. Maybe I will move my apartment, move and live next door to the hospital. Who knows? It's difficult to be certain. But all these things certainly limit in the last examples, they certainly limit my autonomy, my ability to choose for myself. Just do I want to travel or not? If I can't travel because I'm afraid to be away from the hospital because Cardicio has told me that I have this heart problem, well, that's taking away from my freedom to do what I want with my life. So this question about where you put the threshold is an autonomy question, right? Is it red only if you're going to die within a week? Or is it red if you might die within the next 10 years? Where do you put the red? Where do you put the green? One solution is you say, well, wait a minute, maybe we should introduce a new color, like yellow, right? You say, look, red is for people who are really actually might die within the next couple of years. Would have a 50% probability of dying within the next 5 years. That's pretty serious. Maybe green is people who have only a 1% chance of dying within the next 5 years. And then yellow would be somewhere in between, or adjust it where you want. But the question is, and here's what I'm getting to, where do you put those thresholds to maximize user autonomy? That's different than the medical question, which is where do you put those thresholds to maximize user heart health? If you just want to maximize heart health, well, in that case, then the red should be all the way down to even the very slim possibilities of a heart attack. Because if you only care about biology, if you only care about keeping someone healthy, well, then don't have any fun, don't drink, don't smoke, don't go travel, don't just exercise, right? Exercise and always be near the hospital. That's true. You could maximize your biological health that way, but you're giving up all of your autonomy. The question we were asking them is, well, let's not think about biological health for your product. Let's think about autonomy for your product. So if you make it all green, everything is green, well, then you're taking away from people's autonomy, at least the ones who are really have a good chance of a heart attack, because they probably want to know that for their lives, right? To make free and good choices. I guess this would be within the theory of the practical theory of autonomy, within this area where we talk about freedom. Our self-determination also requires information, like understanding the truth about the world. I think we're kind of in that zone here. You do help my autonomy, help me make decisions about my own life, if I really have a high probability of a heart disease or heart attack. You really do help me if you tell me that. But if it's a very slight possibility, you don't want to say that I'm red, and you might not want to say that I'm yellow either. If you want to maximize my autonomy, my ability to make free decisions about my own life. But if you don't want to make everything red, you want to make a lot of it green or a lot of it yellow, well, where do you draw the line? Is it a 10% chance of heart attack in the next 10 years? 20%? 30? What's the number? That's a really hard decision. How can this is what we talked with them about. We said, look, because initially they were just thinking biologically. They just said, look, let's just make it red if there's any biological problem and green if there isn't. That meant almost everyone was getting red. So their lives were being wrecked by this, this test. The test was supposed to help them. It was supposed to help them live a better life. But it was making them live a worse life because everyone came out worried out of their minds about their heart rate or their heart health. So that's the first question I wanted to ask about Cardicio. And I want to say that this is a question that shows how AI ethics intersects with the real user experience in the real world and with profit. I mean, Cardicio's product was terrible because everyone was just worried out of their minds about having a heart attack. To make it a good product, to make it helpful to users, they had to take into consideration questions about user autonomy. They had to ask, well, how can we diagnose your health biologically perfectly? Instead, how can we maximize your autonomy in life with this health data? That's a really different project. And getting that project right is extraordinarily difficult. But that requires, amongst other things, it requires trying to figure out where to put these thresholds. You know, at what point do we go from red down to yellow? So you go from go to the doctor right now and eat, change your lifestyle and your habits and everything, down to be aware, maybe come back next year, do the test again, down to all good, get out of here, go live your life, don't come back, right? Or at least don't come back for 10 years. Where are those steps and how can you arrange those steps again, not to maximize biological health, but to maximize how the ability users have to make free determinations about their own existence? And then just some particular details there. there are all kinds of sub questions here. Like what we were saying up to now, well, if someone comes out in really bad shape, you should tell them immediately. But then on the other hand, you have to remember that once you get that kind of news, human minds are not like computers. You can't delete information. You cannot unknow. Just like you cannot unsee. We've all seen videos that we cannot unsee. Some are flashing in my mind right now. Right? That's a terrible thing. I can't erase it. We've all had that experience, right? Well, the same thing with information about your health. You can't unknow that information. So there's also, we were saying up to now that if it's red and really bad, you should tell the user that, but maybe not. I mean, maybe if it's really, really bad, maybe if Cardicio knows you're going to die within 24 hours, maybe it's better to not tell them. Maybe it's better to just not say anything and just let the user live their last 24 hours living instead of being afraid of life. I don't know. That's a hard question, though. Are there ever times when Cardicio, the company, should not tell the user what's going to happen to them? And if they decide that, how could they justify that? Can they justify that in terms of user autonomy? They can say, look, it's true for biological health, we should tell them, but for their life, in order to live freely and make their own determinations, we should just not tell them. Because if we do, they're just going to collapse in worry. Their last 24 hours are going to be a waste. We should just not tell them. And do they have the right? This is something we'll talk about later in the area of human dignity. But we'll just quickly say, I mean, there's also the question, well, I mean, do they have the right to not tell them? Or do they have the right to tell them? Oh, there's a lot going on, you can see. But just sticking with the idea of pure autonomy, what we're trying to do, remember, is maximize autonomy. And the question here is, first, where do we put those thresholds? At what point do we say, look, your situation is one, don't worry about it so much, go live your life, but come back next year. And your situation is, go live your life, don't come back for a decade. And your situation is, you've got to worry. Where do you draw those lines? And then, again, there's these special cases. If it's really bad, what do you do? And the decisions you make, if you make decisions in terms of user autonomy, are completely different than the decisions you will make if you make the decision in terms of biological health. And that's a mistake the company made. They started out thinking, we're a biological health company, which they are. And so we'll make our decisions in those terms, which they did. But that was a terrible way to make decisions. It was terrible for the profit of the company because people hated the service. Everyone came out feeling bad. And it was terrible for the life of the users, for their autonomy. So it's a good example. This is a good example of how AI ethics is necessary. If you don't have ethics in your applications, you will fail just like they did. Well, they didn't because they came to us. Okay, so that's one. That's one good case. Another good case. This one I did not work on myself. This is a general case, but it asks some good questions, and it's becoming increasingly important because of this idea of dynamic insurance. Dynamic insurance is happening everywhere now. Dynamic insurance is this idea that the companies, the insurance companies, say, if you have car insurance, they're gathering vast amounts of information now about how you drive, how well you drive, and so on. And I've already seen, I can't remember which company it was, but I was just seeing just the other day, there was an ad for car insurance where they said, look, we're going to put a kind of a reader in your car that determines how fast you're accelerating and how fast you're braking and that kind of how fast you're going, that kind of stuff. And then we will gauge your car insurance rate in accordance with that data. So, I mean, obviously, if someone's constantly driving 75 miles an hour in 55 mile an hour zones, that's not good. It probably indicates a likelihood of having a car accident. And so your insurance premium will go up. Whereas by contrast, if you only drive once a week and you never leave the city streets, so you're never going faster than 25 miles an hour, well, then your chances of having an accident, at least a accident which is very expensive, which totals the car, you know, your chances of having an accident that ruins the car are pretty slim. So in that case, it seems like your insurance premium would go down. Initially, at least, this makes a lot of sense. And then there's a question about autonomy. There's a question, there's the commercial question, that is the profit and loss question. This should help insurance companies make more money because they can find people who are the larger risks and charge them a lot more money, and then maybe they will leave the company. That's what an insurance company wants, right? The insurance company wants to insure people who will never make any claims. Of course, that's what they want. So if you're offering car insurance, then you want to only insure, right, the so-called, you know, the 80-year-old grandma who only drives to church once a week. That's your preferred client, because that person is never going to have an accident. And so you want to get rid of, you know, the 22-year-old who's driving 75 in the 35-mile-an-hour zone. You don't want that for your client. And it's hard to cherry pick. It has been hard to cherry pick up to now, but with this, the new technology, it's becoming much easier for the insurance company to cherry pick in that way. So that's what's going on. That's what dynamic insurance is. And then you could imagine, starting with cars, because that's where you can get a lot of data, good data, really quickly. But it easily moves on to things like health insurance, too. Like, if you're wearing I'm not, but so I don't know why I'm showing you, but imagine you're wearing a smartwatch. If the insurance company sees, oh, look, I'm connected to your smartwatch, and I see, and it's the health insurance, and I see that you have now stationed yourself on a mountain in the Alps at the triple, I'm not sure what the run, the most extreme, but the triple black diamond X, you know, don't go here, vertical drop run. You know, I see that my client has just stationed themselves at the top of that run. That might be a moment, if I'm a health insurance company, where I say, wait a minute, we've got to raise your health insurance premium and raise it a lot, like right now. You could even imagine, like, the health insurance company saying, like, you know, ding, ding, ding on your phone, just as you're about to go down, you know, don't go down that hill. We know from your experience skiing, from the other hills we've seen you go down, that you can't handle that hill. And we don't want to pay your medical bills because you break your leg on this mountain. So we could easily imagine a health insurance company doing that, just pinging you right before you're about to go down, saying, don't do it, please. Question, is this kind of dynamic health insurance, is it helping your autonomy? Is it increasing your user self-determination? And again, here, this is a really hard question, because on the one side, like I said, in the case of the car or the case of the health insurance, you are signing up for this service. You are saying, look, I want to get my, the reason people would sign up for this, for the car one or the health insurance one, is because they want to live in a more healthy way, and they think their premium, their health insurance, will go down. And that makes a lot of sense. And that's definitely, obviously, an autonomous decision. That's a decision of self-determination. You're taking control of your life. You're imposing rules upon yourself, saying, look, I'm not going to do this ski run, or I'm not going to do this, or I'm not going to do this. Well, first it's, I am going to impose the rule where I will let the insurance company set my rate. That's the first autonomy, self-determination. And the second one is that I will drive slower and so on so that my rate goes down. So it starts out, there's no question about it, it starts out as an autonomy choice. It increases your self-determination. It lets you make more choices about your own life. Obviously, everyone agrees about that. The problem is, does it become an autonomy trap? I mean, once you make that decision to go into the program where you give them all this information about you, then does it end up being a situation where you feel like your self-determination is being robbed from you? Because every time you think you want to do something, like try, you know, many of us live like that. We say, look, you know, I'm ready to try this hard ski run. Maybe not the triple black diamond, but we do want to challenge ourselves. And that's why we want to, that's part of the reason of why we want to be free. But if the second we go up there to do that, all of a sudden our phone starts ding, ding, dinging madly, right? Well, then maybe we're giving back that autonomy we thought we had gotten. Maybe now we're not as free actually to choose for ourselves. Maybe we're not, don't have the sensation that we're giving rules to ourselves about where or how we will live our life or which ski run we will go down or how we will drive our car. So how do you balance those two things? I mean, on the one side, when you sign up for this kind of insurance, there's no doubt that's an autonomy boosting decision. I'm taking control of my life. I'm making a rule and applying it to myself. And I'm doing it for a good reason, to lower my premium. But at what point, if ever, does it turn into a net loss? Does it turn out to be that because of this constant bing-binging on my phone, right? I don't feel as though I can make decisions for myself anymore about how I will live my life. I'm not sure what that point would be, or even how you would measure that. But this is another example, like the Cardicio example, where you could imagine, right, a kind of curve where you say, look, to a certain point for the insurance company, when we offer people dynamic insurance, up to a certain point, it helps their autonomy. But after a certain point, it begins harming their autonomy or taking away their autonomy. And then you could figure out, if you're working for the insurance company, well, where is that point? How do we find it out? How do we discover it? And then you might want to ask subsequently, does that point, how does that correspond with, or does it correspond with profit for the company? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but you would probably want to know that. You would want to say, look, if I'm looking to maximize the autonomy of my clients, am I also maximizing profit for myself? So those are two different curves which you would have to explore. And the maximizing the autonomy curve, that's a hard question. As I say, you need to find some way to measure, some way to determine, you know, where the line is increasing and where it's decreasing. Maybe giving one warning is actually an autonomy positive, right? If you just give someone one warning and you say, this hill looks like a little bit of a challenge, think twice about it, maybe that's good, right? Maybe that helps me decide for myself if I want to do this hill. And maybe it's not good if it's like the seatbelt thing that goes in the car when you forget to put the seatbelt on, say ding, 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 shut up, it just won't stop. Maybe at that point, it's taking away from your autonomy. And then how do you find the intermediate point? Something like that is a hard project, but it's a terrifically important project. The insurance company wants to know. They want to know because they, just for profit, they want their users to be happy. They don't want them to feel like they're being incarcerated by their own decisions. They don't want users to feel like their freedom is completely destroyed by their own free decision to sign up for this policy. So both ethically, autonomy matters. If you want to help people live better lives, you want to help the insurance company help people be free. But even if you don't want that, even if you don't care about social well-being and that stuff, even if you only care about making money, you still want to know. Because if you don't, people will leave your insurance, right? I mean, no one is going to support or bear signing up for a kind of dynamic insurance if they're getting warnings and ding, ding, dingings constantly about everything all the time, it will drive them insane. They'll stop. They'll cancel the policy, of course. So ethics and profit, they intersect again here. We have the theoretical question: how can I freely limit my own freedom? That's a fun question. Or can I freely limit my own freedom? That's a fun question. Just to think about, right? If I sign, it's an odd situation that I'm using freedom to limit my own freedom, because I'm signing up for this policy. Like I say, it's clear that initially it's a freedom positive decision, because you're applying rules to yourself, right? You're deciding for yourself, self-determination to sign up. But at some point it might flip. All right, so why don't you take a few minutes to think about that question. I mean, is it possible for freedom to destroy freedom? Maybe not. I mean, maybe I'm formulating that wrong, incorrectly. Maybe if the initial freedom is a free choice, then you can't ever undo your own freedom, no matter what happens later on. I'm not sure. Okay, so the last thing to talk about is challenges to autonomy. And all this, of course, is within the area of artificial intelligence, data, algorithms, big data and algorithms. And there are two general areas of discussion that we will have. One is in this area of nudges. What is a nudge? What does it mean to nudge someone? And what does that have to do with artificial intelligence? And then the other area is the area of something called dark patterns, which is also kind of a question of nudging, but it's nudging, which is, as its name indicates, is a little bit more aggressive, or which in terms of at least autonomy is a little bit more dark. It seems to manifestly take away from people's autonomy. So let's think about these challenges to autonomy. And we'll start with the idea of a nudge. What is a nudge? Well, this is from a very famous book from 2008 by Cass Sunstein. And I can't remember what Thaler's first name is, but it's Cass Sunstein and Thaler. And the book is just called Nudge. And that's how they define it. Any aspect of the choice architecture that alters people's behavior in a predictable way without forbidding any options. That's really key. A nudge, for it to be a nudge, nothing can be explicitly forbidden, right? It can't be. I mean, nudge is not saying, the policeman's saying, you have to go left, you cannot go right. That is not a nudge, right? A nudge has to leave open the ability for you to turn your car left or turn your car right. Or as this example illustrates, and presumably for it to be a nudge, there needs to be an escalator or an elevator that is working right next to this, right? I mean, if you just say, I'm going to turn off the elevator and make people take the stairs because they will burn calories, that's not a nudge. The nudge is you have the escalator and you have the stairs and you try to alter people's choice architecture. You try to get them to take the stairs because it's good for them by giving them these little signs saying, look, you can burn some calories. You can do some weight loss right here, right now. Just take the stairs instead of the elevator. That's a nudge. Right. A nudge means that you're altering people's choices, but without forbidding things. Right. It's altering without forbidding things. And they also make the point that it's without changing their economic incentives. Right. I mean, it's also true. You can always nudge people. You can always get someone to take the stairs by giving them a dollar at the top if they get to the top on the stairs. Or $10 or some amount, depends on how long the stairs are. But in that case, too, that's not a nudge. That's just a profit. It's a reward. That's a reward system. A nudge is the way that is the idea that you will change someone's behavior without prohibitions and without explicit rewards like money. Obviously, there is a reward here, too. It's the idea that you will lose some weight, but it's not like we're buying you off, right? You're doing it, you're making your own choice You're saying, look, it's a little bit maybe it is at least a little bit discomforting to have to walk up the stairs, but it's worth it to burn these calories. And I make that decision myself. It's a free choice. It's an expression of my autonomy. But what the nudge does is it helps me, in a certain sense, visualize the choice. And it helps me visualize it in a way that appeals to my particular, many people have the desire to lose a little bit of weight, appeals to my particular desire to lose a little bit of weight. Now, this is a simple nudge here on these stairs, but what artificial intelligence does in big data is that it supercharges, potentially, the ability to nudge people by appealing to our specific and unique psychological profiles, by appealing to, let's just say something like this. Maybe if I am trying to lose weight, then this sign on the stairs is going to be very effective. But if I'm not trying to lose weight, and maybe maybe I'm actually, the doctors told me I've gone too far, I'm too thin, I should rest for a while and get some weight back, then maybe this same set of arrows and words is going to discourage me from taking the stairs. But what artificial intelligence and big data does, and then screens, which allow things to be changed, right, it would allow that signage to be changed to fit my specific situation. So perhaps I'm not on a diet and I don't care about diets, but I do care a lot about feeling healthy. Right? It might change the message to feel one unit energized, feel two units energized, be completely energized. And maybe that appeals to someone like me. Maybe, as I say, I'm thin and I don't really need to worry about a diet. So the nudge of calories does nothing for me, but energy and energizing, that does, because I'm interested in feeling vivid and alive. So what big data does is it allows us to know the user, right? This is privacy, but we'll talk about this later. But of course, Amazon and the credit card companies, all these companies, they know a lot about us, right? I mean, if I sign up to go to the gym, then probably the credit card company can figure out that I am worried about my weight and my diet, right? And so they can figure out this kind of nudge will work for me. But if I've never signed up to go to the gym and I never do any weight loss, they look at my grocery bill, there's no weight loss stuff on there, I'm eating cookies all the time and stuff, then they know that this kind of nudging will not work for me, but they might know something else that does work for me. Maybe I on my credit card, they see I'm always going to dance classes. And so a different kind of nudge would be, this is the one step, two step of the waltz or something. You know, practice your waltz steps up the stairs. You know, that might appeal to me. So the idea of data and algorithms and artificial intelligence here is the idea that a lot of data is being, we all know, a lot of data is being gathered about us every day, all the time. And that data can be combined with knowledge about what appeals to people, right? And artificial intelligence can look at nudges that have worked and not worked in the past, and seeing that when you show people on the screen who are interested in diets, when you show them an activity they can do that will burn some calories right now, then they're likely to do that activity. So that's the way nudging works. And that's also the way it is supercharged by artificial intelligence. If, as we know more about specific people, have more of their personal information, and we know more about how people in different situations react to nudges. If you're on a diet, you do one thing. If you're worried about dancing, you do something else or something else, right? Then it becomes very easy for nudges to be something like manipulation. Right? It can be almost a constant stream of things that we are receiving that are designed to appeal to what we are interested in, And again, it might not be that we are being forced to do something. It might not be that we are getting money to do something, but it's pushing us a little bit in one direction or the other. And again, the possibility of nudging increases radically as personal information about users, people like me and you, is accumulated by companies, and as artificial intelligence allows that information to be used and targeted more specifically with greater efficacy, that the worries about nudges increase. Okay, so that's what a nudge is. I think that the question about whether or not this is interferes with your autonomy, I mean, is really clear. It's just there. I mean, on one hand, I mean, we are free. If I see this in the stairs and I go up the stairs, I mean, it's true that I'm freely making that decision. And I think it is a good case of autonomy. I mean, I see the opportunity to lose calories. I impose that rule upon myself. I'm going to take the stairs to lose these calories, and I do it. Sounds like autonomy. But certainly there's a point where that can transfer into manipulation. And so here's a case here, which is kind of interesting, because it's a case where it seems like the nudge is not necessarily a bad thing, even though it does seem to interfere with, at least it seems to me, to potentially interfere with the user's autonomy. And so the example, this is from an article by Bornstein and Arkin from some time ago, 2017. They say, look, robots, and when they say robots, they mean something like a chatbot, right? The Amazon Alexa or something like that. Could include verbal prompts to donate money to a cause like the American Heart Association. If a robot possesses the capacity, that is, if Amazon knows a detailed user profile, then offering specifically tailored recommendations becomes a distinct possibility. For example, if the user has a family history of a particular illness, like heart attack, the robot could suggest contributing to an associated charity, the American Heart Association. Right? So, what's going on here? What's going on here is something like the American Heart Association, which is a charity in which, I'm not sure, I haven't studied them, but let's just imagine for our presentation that they are good and generous people who are taking money and really using it for solving medical problems about heart health. So it's a good group of people, generous, hardworking, and so on. And so giving money to them, yes, it seems like a good thing, right? So let's just take that as an assumption. It's a good thing. But wait a minute now, because what's happening here is they are making an appeal, let's just say, that they are making an appeal based upon your vulnerability to worry about heart disease because it runs in your family. Or let's imagine even a stronger case. Let's say that my father died yesterday, I'm just making this up again, from a heart attack, and all of a sudden today, the American Heart Association sends me an ad on my screen saying, look, donate to the American Heart Association. Well, that's a nudge, because it's not forcing me to do that, and it's not offering me any financial reward to do that. But it's taking advantage of my state of mind, right? Because right now I'm really acutely concerned about and hate heart disease. So am I really free if I'm getting, am I making a free decision about donating to the American Heart Association if I get this message? I guess it's from the chatbot, so imagine it's from Alexa, whatever it's called, the Amazon thing, tells me, it gives me that possibility, or if I see that ad on my screen, again, that's a nudge. No one is forcing me to give money to the American Heart Association. But are they diminishing my autonomy by presenting me with this nudge? Or then another example, just a pet one of mine, I guess like many people, I just hate this constant, now everything is a tip. and they swing that, someone just gives you a coffee at the counter and they swing the thing around, which do you choose? 18% tip or 55% tip? And then the, if you say no tip, it's only a tiny button on the bottom. And you feel like you're being watched. Well, no one is forcing you to give the 85% tip. You can give zero tip if you want. But you feel kind of self-conscious, right? You feel like, on the one hand, I really don't feel like I should have to give a 95% tip to someone who just handed me a cup of coffee. But on the other hand, I feel self-conscious and they've put this thing here. No one is forcing me. But that's a nudge. So the American Heart Association showing me this ad or the tip thing turned around. Are these limitations or attacks upon our autonomy? Or instead, are they opportunities to exercise our autonomy? Are they moments where we can say, look, I'm going to put down my own rule for myself and I'm going to make a decision? Maybe you could say the other, take it the other way and say, look, far from being, in the case of the American Heart Association, far from being an exploitation and a diminishment of your autonomy, maybe you could say it's an opportunity to exercise your autonomy. So it's positive in that way. Unclear. One thing that is clear, however, and that is certain, is that the accumulation of personal data about users combined with the artificial intelligence understanding of how users in the past have reacted to situations, which are like the one you find yourself in now, those things together, those powers are increasing. And so we will be increasingly faced with these kinds of nudges. And so we will have to decide, are these violations of our autonomy, or are they opportunities to exercise our autonomy? And how do we measure that? Right? At what point does the line get crossed? If the American Heart Association just shows us an ad for this charity the day after my father dies, that's fairly weak, right? That is not very compelling. But you can imagine how they could personalize that and say on the ad, like, has someone you known died recently from a heart attack? You're like, yes. Well, then you can help. Donate to the American Heart Association, right? That's much more compelling. Does the autonomy level change from one ad to the other? Or is your autonomy being diminished? That's the kind of question which would be addressed here in the case of a nudge. And then if you came to the conclusion that your autonomy was being diminished, you might also have another ethical question, which is, well, is it okay for the American Heart Association to do that because it's a good charity? But it's not okay for the Starbucks people to do that because they're just a for-profit company grubbing for money? Are those two situations different? Or instead, are they really just the same? Is it just two different ways that your autonomy is either being diminished or giving you the opportunity to express, to be expressed? Unclear. But this is the kind of thing the kind of issue that people are wrestling with today in the area of what are called nudges. That is, control or influencing individuals without prohibitions and without direct monetary rewards. Now, the area of nudges is, as I say, that's an area of debate, right? That's an area where people are saying, look, you can take one side or you can take the other. Maybe it's helping your autonomy. Maybe it's not. Let's think more about this. But you can push it a little further toward nudges that are pretty clearly trying to take away your autonomy. And when you get there, you get to something called dark patterns. Example here is user interface design choices that benefit an online service by coercing, steering, or deceiving users. Yeah, I guess that seems a little extreme to me. It's not quite that extreme. That's wrong. It's not quite that extreme, a dark pattern. But dark patterns are, I think my definition is better, they're misleading links, boxes, pre-check forms for spam. They're things that don't prohibit anything. They're not coercive. They're not forcing you to do anything. But they're definitely steering you in one direction. And so here's one, and you see this all the time. You can buy a pair of shoes. This is a real example. You can buy a pair of shoes and insurance for shoes. Come on. You don't need insurance for shoes, but they want you to waste your money on the insurance. And so they make it this color and it almost becomes automatic, right? When you're doing these things, you're just flying through the page and there's always some stuff you have to check and you have to click. And it's just so easy to just add to basket with insurance, right? But something like that clearly, it's not coercing, but it is steering you to make a decision without thinking. That's what they want. It's obvious. They want you to add the insurance to your basket and pay for it without first, right? That's why it's like that. And they're using, it's very slight, right? They just put that color there so it kind of draws the attention of the cursor and you're frustrated. It takes so long and you have stuff to do. You just hit it and go. That's a nudge. Again, nothing is being forbidden. You're perfectly free to add to the basket without insurance, perfectly free to do it, of course. So it's just a nudge. It's not a prohibition, but it sure seems like the goal is entirely to take away your ability to make the right decision for you. It sure seems like it. And when it's like that, when the goal clearly is to take away your ability to make your own decision, that's a dark pattern. That's where a nudge crosses into being a dark pattern. And of course, sneakers, I mean, insurance, who cares? But that technology, that ability will become more serious and be applied to more serious questions as time goes on. And then I think even more extreme case of dark patterns is when you use artificial intelligence and specifically sort of biological information to, again, you're not forcing anyone to do anything, but you're really trying to take away, really trying to stop them from making a free decision and just steering them in a certain direction. And Facebook does this very well through the careful administration of dopamine, which is the brain, the chemical in your brain, which, if I understand correctly, I think this is right, is related to, or is even the same as the drug that is released when you get some addictive drugs like heroin or opiates or cocaine, that in that kind of area. Hey, you feel good. When dopamine and other things you can do without drugs that also make you feel very good, you want that sensation. People will do, all you need to do is go out into the street and look. For that sensation, people will do quite a bit. They'll do all kinds of things because they want to get that dopamine rush. What Facebook learned how to do with their little like button is, they learned that when your post on Facebook got a like, it released just a little bit. It's just a little bit of dopamine. It's not like euphoric joy, at least not usually, when someone gives you a like. But Facebook learned that, yes, that's the way our brains react. And you do get a biological drug released when you get that like. And so, through artificial intelligence, they learned how to administer this drug. I mean, if you give too many likes, everything is like, then the brain, it's too easy. The brain stops releasing the dopamine. But if you almost never give the like, then you kind of forget, your brain forgets that I will get the dopamine if I do something. You have to administer it perfectly. You have to administer it well. You have to give it frequently enough so that the brain remembers, but not so frequently that it just says, forget it, it's not worth the effort. So what Facebook learned to do is to give you likes. Of course, it has not. Of course, it has nothing to do with what people really like and don't like. Of course not. What they actually do is they give you the likes or arrange for you to get the likes by showing your post to more people or fewer people. They arrange that easily, right, with big data and algorithms. If they figure that you need now a bit of dopamine to stay on the platform, you need a like, right, to get that rush in your brain and stay using Facebook, then what do? They start showing your post to more and more people until finally someone, thank God, pushes the like. And so you get that like, and then bang, they stop showing your post. So that's the way they decide how to show your post to other people. They show it just frequently enough so that they can give you the feedback that will keep you on the platform, right? So that's how you know, right? And that you can, if you want to double reverse psychology, you can manipulate Facebook. You can just put a senseless post that's silly, but they will still keep pushing it out there until someone finally likes it. So if you want to make them waste their time, you can give them a dumb post and then stay on platform long enough so you still need a like. Facebook figures they need to give you a like that will force them to show this bad post over and over again. That's if you're mischievous and devious and want to harm Facebook. But who would want to do that? The main point is that dark patterns at the extreme can be intersected with literally biological, physiological, with drugs in your own body. So at this point, then, there is this question. If we say that a nudge is a way of steering people's behavior, but without prohibitions, without forcing one way or the other, without coercion, and if it steers you but leaves the free choice to be yours, then in this case, is this still a nudge? And is Facebook still involved in nudges if it is literally using the release of dopamines? It's controlling that release through its use of likes and other things. If it's using drugs to keep you on the Facebook platform, then is this still a nudge? And if it's not a nudge, if this is coercion, if you're being forced, like a drug addict is kind of forced to stay on platform, well, then we can say absolutely that Facebook is an anti-autonomy platform. But that's not necessarily the case. Maybe this is still a nudge because you're the one choosing to get involved in these likes. I mean, at any time, like the people who own Facebook correctly and to their credit say directly, anytime you want, close the laptop, disconnect from the computer. You're free to do that. Of course you are. So the case can strongly be made in favor of Facebook to say, look, Facebook is an autonomy positive organization. Facebook serves your ability to make your own decisions. You can always turn it off. And as long as that's true, then everything that follows afterward, all the happiness and the dopamine and all that stuff, those are not violations of your autonomy or limitations of your autonomy. They're just expressions of autonomy. They're just you having fun. And it is fun, right? Getting likes, it feels good. That's why people do it. So Facebook can make the strong case that their platform is autonomy positive. You make the choice to go onto it. You make the choice to get involved in this pursuit of likes, and you feel good because of it. Or maybe you don't, but that's your own fault. If you don't feel good, it's your fault, and it's your freedom's fault. Not anybody else's fault. But again, right, there's the other case where you can say, when it gets to the point where drugs are being released in your brain, then we talked about that in terms of the three levels upon which practical autonomy functions, the level of physical freedom, mental freedom, and psychological freedom. And we said psychological freedom is this idea that you can think clearly, right? You're not drugged. Well, I mean, it seems like in this case that maybe Facebook is limiting your ability to think clearly. So on the psychological level, it is inhibiting your autonomy. And for that reason, you could conclude ethically that Facebook is not an autonomy positive platform, even though it's true and undeniable that at any time anyone using Facebook can move their cursor up and log out. Of course, that's true. So it's hard to know. I mean, which is it? Even at the extreme case where you have biology involved, is Facebook a nudge or is it a dark pattern, right? We wanted to say the dark pattern. A dark pattern is a kind of case where they're clearly just trying to trick you. That's it, right? And so that's an anti-autonomy. But Facebook, log out anytime you want. Is it a nudge? Or again, is it a dark pattern? Is it more manipulative and a true diminishment of your autonomy? That's the question. I'm not sure what the answer is, but why don't we take the last 5 minute break we're going to have and the subject of autonomy, and you can think about that yourself a little bit. It doesn't have to be Facebook, all the big social media platforms in one way or another do things like that. In one way or another, they're feeding you likes or thumbs up or whatever it is, or hearts or what have you. They're feeding you those things to keep you on platform. And the question is this a kind of enhancement of self-determination? Is it an opportunity for you to use your own ability to make your own decisions? Yes. Or is it, after being initially an opportunity to make your own decisions, does it convert into a dark pattern and become a loss of autonomy, kind of autonomy trap where you can't get out of, off the platform? Hard decision. Okay. And then the last, this is very quick, the last thought about autonomy. Autonomy is we're having this discussion now, but it has been a discussion since philosophy started. And one of the initial discussions about autonomy as it exists in the world of artificial intelligence started in the 1960s and 70s. And it surrounded this guy with the longish hair. That's Gilles Deleuze. The guy with no hair, that's Michel Foucault. And the guy in the middle in the background there with it looks like his eyes are a little bit misaligned, because they are misaligned. Jean-Paul Sartre. He is the existentialist philosopher from the pre-World War II, or when was Sartre? World War II-ish. Deleuze and Foucault are from the 1960s to about 2000. And what I want to talk about here is Gilles Deleuze. And to a degree, Foucault contributed to this a little bit too. This idea, Deleuze proposed a society of control. And this is sort of future scene. If you're interested in this idea of autonomy and the way artificial intelligence uses the idea of nudges to control people, and you want to ask, well, is this helping us be free or is this limiting our freedom? One essay you can look at is the one by Gilles Deleuze called Postscript on Societies of Control. And it is precisely about, it's not about artificial intelligence because it's before artificial intelligence, but it's about the idea of what control is. And he defines control before the whole nudge stuff happened. Control is nudge, right? So this is where nudge actually came from. It's not the Cass Sunstein, it's actually Deleuze. And he again, he used the term control, and control is guiding or steering people without prohibitions. And he actually got the idea from Kafka, Kafka's book, the Trial, in which Kafka is, he's never denied anything, but no verdict ever appears for his case. And he doesn't even know exactly where the case is and which room he has to go to. He's constantly wandering around, basically being driven crazy, but without ever being told that he can or can't do anything. It's a bizarre story. That's Kafka's The Trial. That's taking us way, way off where we're going, but the Deleuze, no. So again, it's the Postscript on Societies of Control. It's a very short essay. I strongly recommend it because it is about this question of human autonomy and whether or not it is possible to diminish human autonomy, to make you and I less free without prohibitions, right? Without forcing you to do one thing or another. And Deleuze's answer is yes. And that answer fits very well with what we have been talking about in terms of nudges and artificial intelligence. Now, I'm not sure Deleuze is right. You have to decide for yourself that. But if you want an intellectual background to this notion of nudges and to the question about whether or not artificial intelligence and social media and the suggestions we're getting all the time, LinkedIn and Tinder and Netflix and Facebook, all that stuff, whether or not these things are part of a constant movement toward increasing our autonomy, our self-determination, our ability to make decisions for ourselves, or they're part of a movement toward control or nudges, that is, our loss of autonomy, our loss of self-determination, our loss of ability to make decisions for ourselves. If you're interested in these questions, and then last quick footnote, if you're doing computer science, you probably should be, because, not because I'm making some claim for philosophy or something, no, because for real products that exist in the real world, like Cardicio, like Netflix, like Dynamic Insurance, for real products that exist in the real world, these questions are really pressing. Companies that don't understand autonomy will not make good decisions in the marketplace. They will fail. I'm not saying that to be successful in the marketplace, you've got to know Gilles Deleuze. That's going a little too far. You don't need to know Deleuze, but you do need to understand what autonomy is, and you need to understand how it functions, how it increases and decreases in the kinds of big data environments that are increasingly prevalent and that are exemplified by the case of Cardicio or Dynamic Insurance. Okay? All right. So that's the autonomy discussion.